From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the predictions of psychic Joseph Jacobs, and he'll take your calls. Now, normally this is a Linda Moulton Howe night. She's on the last Thursday of every month. She is taking 2 months off. 2 months off. She'll be back with us the end of August. Here's what's happening. Despite North Korea's promise to work toward complete denuking following the historic summit with Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump earlier this month, new satellite imagery indicates North Korea is making improvements to one of its nuclear scientific research centers at an incredibly rapid pace. I don't know what this means, but we've got a lot of government officials a little concerned about this. The Army is massively reviving up its fleet of Bradley fighting vehicles, including tanks, through a recent deal to add up to 473 of the new military carriers. The move represents a key portion of a broader Army push to prepare its arsenal of armed combat vehicles for major power land wars and further pave the way toward a new generation of combat platforms for what they say 2030s and beyond. Amid the public harassment of Trump officials, exemplifying a sharply divided nation, 42% of American voters now believe that a second civil war is likely to happen within the next 5 years. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi, author of Killing the Deep State. Jerry, that's kind of a frightening number.
It's a very frightening number, George, and encouragement by Maxine Waters of hard left activists to attack those who are working for the Trump administration does not help. But I still don't think we're at the point of a civil war. I think the divisions are sharp, but you know, we've had divisions before in the country that have been sharp, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to come to a more centrist kind of view of debate and argument in the country. Not so polarized, but I'm not 100% sure that that'll happen.
No, I'm not either, Jerry. And the way things have been going lately, I mean, there's just something I can't put my fingers on. There's just too much bitterness going on. What's your take on all that?
Well, I share that, George. I mean, it's like the hard left looks at everything Donald Trump does is demonized. I mean, it's all terrible, no matter what happens. And you know, clearly, even when there was opposition to Barack Obama, but it was mostly respectful opposition. Now the lack of respect and the anger has gotten to a new intensity. So it does concern me, but I'm still optimistic we'll come to some middle ground where debate can come back to a reasonable level.
Okay, Jerry, thank you. Dr. Jerome Corsi, again, author of the best-selling book, Killing the Deep State. Joe Jackson, the father of the late Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson and the mastermind behind the Jackson 5, has died at the age of 89. The legendary stage parent and music manager was reportedly battling terminal cancer. In New York, authorities say a Sussex County man fatally shot his wife because he believed she was possessed. County prosecutors say the 79-year-old man was in the midst of an acute psychiatric event when he murdered and shot his wife. The couple had been married for 59 years. A Norwegian filmmaker, Kari Lien, began researching online commentators and comments since Christmas Day of 2014. He says he became fascinated by how much hate and ignorance people were writing in the comment sections of news sites. He says, so I began looking at people's profiles, trying to work out who they were. Many seemed quite normal. They had families. They looked like nice people. But the comments they were writing in a public space were so extreme there was a disconnect. And so he began a 3-year journey in the lives of some of the Internet's most prolific online commentators. Now he's got a documentary out called The Internet Warriors, but he says the hate was truly unbelievable. I thought we'd bring in our expert on the Internet, Lauren Weinstein, for a moment. Lauren, are you sensing this, too, that there's just massive hate on websites and places where people comment?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And I think it's useful to kind of break this down a little bit into the different kinds that we see here. there are definitely individuals, genuine, these are, you know, actual genuine individuals who are speaking on their own, and I think that's mainly what this documentarian is talking about there. And then there are organized groups that are basically racist, anti-Semitic, sexist groups. Some of these groups go back to World War II, before World War II, even to before the Civil War.
Oh my gosh.
That have used the internet. They are leveraging the internet to pass out their messages, to disseminate their messages in a way they never could before. It was very expensive just to do mailings, and now the internet, they can reach millions for virtually no money at all. And into the mix here, and I think it's really important to keep this in mind, especially recently, we do definitely have interference from third parties. In particular, we have Putin's trolls, his troll army, that went out there and specifically attempted to foment anger and hate on both sides, often by claiming to be who they weren't, creating sites that claimed to be one side or the other that were actually fake sites, but other people wouldn't know that. They'd read that, they'd participate, they'd get angrier and angrier. So we were basically serving Putin's interest. His interest was in spreading hate. So now we have all this different kind of hate that's mixed together, and it's creating a very, very toxic situation, very difficult for the social media platforms to deal with, all kinds of political ramifications because, of course, politics gets tangled up in all of this. And basically, it's not a very encouraging situation right now.
Now, we track a few websites, and one of my staff members has been following up, much like this documentary producer has been doing, and he has found that there is someone who claims to be a police officer, and we love cops, but that when this person posts on the internet, in the various chat rooms, it is the most vile, hateful stuff you can imagine. Now, the person's not putting his name down. He's hiding under some kind of avatar or something like that. What possesses somebody, a law enforcement officer, a reportedly person with a great solid job, a pillar of the community, to then go online when he comes home at night and becomes a demon?
And indeed, we know of cases where politicians and police officers and other people in responsible roles have been discovered to be behind these kinds of social media profiles and have often lost their jobs as a result. Now, having said that, let's keep in mind that in those cases, you're probably dealing with people who have this false sense of anonymity. They think that somehow no one can ever figure out who they are. And in most cases, that's not true. That's just a false assumption on their part and a very dangerous one also all around.
Why do they hate so much, though?
People just use, because they have that sense of anonymity, they don't think that the usual social constraints are operating
right
for them.
They become a different person.
They become a different person because it's like putting on a mask and going out and saying, no one knows who I am now. The other thing to keep in mind, though, It's the old on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog, that cartoon from many, many years ago. Just because somebody claims they're a police officer and says these terrible things doesn't necessarily mean that they are a police officer.
That's a good
point.
So
it's all mixed up. You just have to be very, very careful about what you believe, because at any given time, you have real haters that are who they claim to be. You have haters who aren't who they claim to be. The only thing they have in common is hate.
Well, in this documentary film, producer says most of the people that he has interviewed subsequently are very lonely people, some of them minimally employed, but they hide behind the internet.
Yeah, and that's a serious problem. It's a problem of our own creation, too, because in a way the internet has brought both more communication than ever before to individuals and more loneliness to many individuals also. And on top of that, when you start bringing in organized groups and then the Russians on top of that, how do you ever untangle a mess like this? I don't have the answer.
You got it. Lauren, thank you so much. Good comments. Japan's Hayabusa 2 spacecraft has been traveling through space for almost 4 years, and it has finally reached its destination. The spacecraft has traveled all the way to a small asteroid for one single purpose, to collect a piece of it and bring it back to planet Earth. I hope it works. Up next, we're going to be talking with David Weintraub. His incredible book is called Life on Mars, What to Know Before We Go. I'm looking forward to this. Welcome back to Coast. David Weintraub with us. David received his bachelor's degree in physics and astronomy at Yale in 1980, his Ph.D. in geophysics and space physics at UCLA back in 1989. He's a professor of astronomy at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, the 2015 winner of the Klopstig Award from the American Association of Physics Teachers. How about that? Which recognizes the outstanding communication of the excitement of contemporary physics to the general public. Congratulations, David, and all your books. It's good to have you on the show. I'm looking forward to it.
Glad to be here with you.
I could not put down Life on Mars today when it showed up this morning. Very well done, and it's exciting. When we ever get there, it's going to be amazing, isn't it?
The things that we may discover truly could be amazing. We just don't know exactly what we will find when we get there.
Now, let me ask you this before we get rolling, because you're in physics. Can you tell me what the Big Bang is?
I can try. The Big Bang is the explanation we have for the beginning of the universe as we know it, when all of the matter and all of the energy of the universe was in one place. And for reasons we do not understand, all the matter and energy flew outwards from that single spot, and slowly over time, the matter and energy collected into stars and galaxies that we see today.
How did it get there in the first place, David?
We don't know that answer.
No. I mean, that's the perplexing question, isn't it?
It's a great question. It's right now beyond the reach of science. We can only understand what we can observe, and we can't observe anything that comes before that first moment of time.
And is it very conceivable we may never get that answer?
It certainly is. We have ideas, and some of those ideas are potentially testable. For example, there could have been pre-existing universes, and collisions of other universes spawned the Big Bang, which created our universe. But that's going to be a very, very difficult idea to test.
I think so, too. So when you were a little boy, were you interested in science and space and astronomy? And I bet you had a telescope, didn't you?
I had a telescope, but quite honestly, I never quite figured out how to use it. I looked through the telescope and nothing seemed to happen. I perhaps wanted it to be more like a video game, which actually didn't exist when I was a kid. So I was interested in understanding how things worked out there, but not so much looking at them. And in fact, when I was a youngster and I joined the Boy Scouts, one of the requirements for getting promoted as a Boy Scout was to identify 10 constellations, and I flunked out of Boy Scouts because I couldn't do it.
Wow.
So looking at the sky wasn't my passion, but understanding what was going on up there, that was my passion.
What was the ding moment for you when you got interested in this again?
I think I grew up during what I would call the first golden age of space exploration. I grew up with the Gemini and Apollo program going to the moon, mm-hmm. and the Mariner program exploring the planets, and the Viking missions going to Mars. And of course, not everybody who grew up at that time became an astronomer, but for some reason, that age of exploration, that got into my gut, and I decided I wanted to be part of that.
I wanted
to be on that journey.
I still have a photograph of the original Mercury 7 astronauts all signed under their pictures.
That's a pretty special thing to have.
Yep, it sure is. And it's just amazing thinking of how we have accomplished so many things. I mean, we landed first on the moon in 1969 with humans. I mean, 48 years ago.
It's a long time.
We're coming up on the
anniversary. But I can remember exactly where I was when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. That was an incredible event. And we are very close to that possibly happening again with a human setting foot on Mars.
Yeah, tell me now about life on Mars and why the fascination with that red planet.
I think from early on in the age of telescopes, so the telescope was invented in about 1609. And soon after the invention of the telescope, astronomers looking at Mars discovered that Mars was simply more interesting than the other planets.
it's closer than Jupiter or Saturn, so we can see more on Mars than on those distant planets. Venus is closer than Mars, but Venus is covered by clouds, and we couldn't see anything on Venus. But in the telescopes looking at Mars, astronomers discovered they could see what looked like structures on the surface of Mars. I shouldn't say structures, but dark splotches on the surface of Mars, and they watched those splotches and they discovered that Mars was rotating. And one of the first discoveries about Mars was that it spins in 24 hours. Now, with refinements on those measurements, we know it's closer to 24 hours and 40 minutes, but that's sort of in the noise of being 24 hours. 24 hours is the Earth's rotation period. The first discovery about Mars was that Mars has a 24-hour day and night, just like the Earth does. Mars was an Earth-like planet. And soon after that, we discovered Mars had polar caps and Mars had seasons. And by the beginning of the 19th century, astronomers were pretty convinced that Mars was pretty much like the Earth. It had a solid surface. It had a thin atmosphere. It had ice caps. It probably had water. If Mars is like the Earth in all those respects, then maybe Mars has oceans and continents and life.
What do you think happened, David, assuming, because I've looked at the color picture of Mars in your book, Life on Mars, and you've got what it looks like and what it could have looked like. What do you think happened if it had that kind of massive size ocean?
Early on in Mars's history, we are quite certain Mars had lots and lots of water. In fact, if you could turn Mars into a perfectly smooth billiard ball, no mountains, no valleys, perfectly uniform surface, and put all the water on the surface, it would form an ocean about 1,000 feet deep on Mars. That's a lot of water. We don't see all that water today. The amount of water we see today is about 10% of that, and it's not liquid on the surface. But once upon a time, Mars had lots and lots and lots of water on it. And we see in the ancient parts of Mars features on the surface that look like river valleys. And in fact, that's what the geologists, the planetary geologists, have termed them. And we also see features that look like giant outflow channels, which are places where there probably were tremendous reservoirs of water underground, maybe as permafrost, that melted, and catastrophically tremendous amounts of water were released, the equivalent of 10 Amazon rivers flowing at once, carving its way across the surface. And we see these channels, but they're on ancient Mars. They're on parts of Mars that we think are unchanged for the last 3 billion years. So we think Mars was once warm and wet, but it's not warm and wet now. Something happened to change Mars.
Where did it go? I mean, did it evaporate? Could that much water over the billions of years simply evaporate? Or where did it go?
That is one possibility. The two possibilities are that some or all of that water is below the surface in underground reservoirs. The other possibility is exactly what you mentioned, that it escaped from space. And almost certainly some of it escaped from space, but probably not all of it did. But we don't know how much is inside Mars and how much escaped to space. Mars is a bit different from the Earth in that the atmosphere is thinner, and there's nothing to keep ultraviolet light from penetrating the atmosphere. We all wear sunscreen, or we should wear sunscreen when we go outside, because a little bit of ultraviolet light gets down to the surface, and ultraviolet light can be dangerous. But our ozone layer protects us from most ultraviolet light from the sun, and Mars doesn't have an ozone layer. So that ozone penetrates the atmosphere very deeply, and a water molecule, when it absorbs ultraviolet light, can get ripped apart. A water molecule is hydrogen and oxygen, and when it gets ripped apart by the energy in ultraviolet light, you get oxygen atoms and hydrogen atoms. And hydrogen atoms are the lightest atoms that exist, and they can bubble up to the top of the atmosphere because they're so light, gravity can't hold them down near the surface. And when they get up to the top of the atmosphere, they can escape to space. So slowly but surely, one molecule at a time, the ultraviolet light can destroy the water, and the hydrogen can escape to space, and the oxygen then is left to rust the rocks. What we call rust is just oxygen combining with iron, iron oxide on Earth. And much of the red color of Mars is iron oxide, all that oxygen that is reacted with iron on the surface to turn it red. So one good possibility is, in fact, that ultraviolet light broke up the water and the hydrogen escaped to space, and much of that water truly is gone.
And if it seeped in, David, we're going to take this break, but if it seeped in, how did it go down there? Was it like some kind of huge drain? What would get the water to go down into the planet? We'll be back. We're with David Weintraub. We're going to take calls with David next hour. We'll be back with him in a moment as we talk about his work called Life on Mars. I tell you what, life in Vancouver, British Columbia is going to be rocking this weekend because we've got an event we're going to, the Architects of the New Paradigm Conference. Full information at coasttocoastam.com. Just click events or look at the carousel, the revolving carousel that pops up. But come on out to Vancouver, British Columbia, if you're in that area or if you have a passport. Then August 25th, Saturday, we will be live in Asheville, North Carolina. Go to dwtheater.com for more information or click events at coasttocoastam.com. Those tickets are selling quickly, only 2 months to go. Go to dwtheater, T-H-E-A-T-R-E, or go to events at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. David Weintraub with us, his book, Life on Mars. David, this system where the water may have just drained into Mars, like percolation, is it like coffee going through a filter? Same kind of principle?
Almost certainly, yes. Just like on the Earth, water drains into the soil and into underground reservoirs. On the Earth, there are there's a water cycle that brings it back up onto the into the surface. On Mars, something must have happened to end that cycle. So for a long time, the water must have gone into Mars and come out of Mars and gone in and come out. But at some point, it stopped coming out. We don't know why.
Now, here, of course, we have clouds and an atmosphere, and we constantly have rain, so more and more water is created. Mars doesn't have that capability, does it?
Well, the water on the Earth is not created. The water is just cycled from the oceans into the atmosphere, down onto the ground, into the rivers, and back into the ground again. So there's a complete circulatory cycle for the water, but we have a fixed amount of water. On Mars, the same rules would apply. Once upon a time, there were almost certainly clouds and streams and rivers and water going into the ground and coming back out and evaporating, but Mars, for reasons, again, we don't completely understand, that cycle was disrupted, maybe because Mars got colder and the atmosphere changed, maybe because the ground, there's no plate tectonics on Mars, maybe the absence of plate tectonics disrupted the system in some way. But again, we just don't know. All we know is there once was lots of water on the surface and in the atmosphere of Mars, and there isn't anymore.
David, I'm hearing dates of 2024, 2030 of trying to colonize Mars. What's going on here?
The corporation SpaceX that Elon Musk started in 2002 is the closest to sending astronauts to Mars. Elon Musk has talked about sending astronauts as soon as 2024. The organization called Mars One, which is a Dutch corporation, talks about establishing a colony on Mars with astronauts by 2032. Dates are very, very soon. I think Elon Musk and SpaceX probably could succeed, if not in 2024, then probably soon thereafter. That assumes their next rocket, called the BFR, for the Big Falcon rocket. The BFR, if it works, will be big enough and powerful enough to get humans to Mars. It will be a bit more powerful than the Saturn V rockets that took astronauts to the moon a generation ago. But that rocket doesn't exist yet. They're supposed to have the first launches of the BFR in 2020. And if they meet their schedule, then they will have a rocket that can get to Mars. They then plan to start using it in 2022 to start sending unmanned payloads to Mars, dropping packages of habitats and food and other supplies on Mars, and follow that up 2 years later with astronauts. Mars One, the Dutch group, they have astronauts and they have investors, but they don't actually have rockets. So I'm not sure how they're planning to get to Mars, but they talk about getting there. NASA is also in this competition. NASA talks about sending astronauts to the Mars system in the 2030s. They are not talking about putting astronauts on the actual surface of Mars, and there are reasons for that. The main reason is it's very, very costly in terms of energy to get down to the surface of Mars safely and then to launch back off the surface to come home. At the moment, we don't have rockets that are strong enough, powerful enough to take us to Mars, onto the surface of Mars, back up, and to bring astronauts home. And even if we had the rockets, once you're on the surface of Mars, you actually need fuel for those rockets to launch off the surface. If your listeners have remembered watching rocket launches from Florida, most of what we see in those rockets are giant fuel tanks. Tremendous amount of energy, tremendous amount of fuel to get off the surface of the Earth. And the same is true on Mars. And if you want to get back off the surface of Mars, you'd either have to take the fuel with you, which we don't know how to do, or you'd have to manufacture the fuel on Mars, which we don't know how to do. So NASA is not yet talking about landing on Mars because NASA couldn't get those astronauts home again. And NASA can't do that because they're using your tax dollars to do that. Elon Musk is talking about sending colonists to the surface of Mars, who he believes will be able to survive on the surface of Mars. And if he can get them there, they better be able to survive on the surface of Mars because he can't bring them home.
Now, are we also talking about the possibility of a one-way trip for an astronaut?
At the moment, the only trip to Mars, to the surface of Mars that is possible, is a one-way trip. A NASA trip in which we send astronauts into orbit around Mars but not down to the surface, we could probably bring them home again. But at the moment, nobody, not SpaceX, not Mars One, not NASA, nobody can send someone to the surface of Mars and get them back off the surface and bring them home. So, yes, at the moment, anybody who goes to Mars is contemplating a one-way mission.
There are some people who actually would do that, David, and gosh, I don't know how they can mentally.
I think there are lots and lots of people who would do it for lots of reasons. I'm not one of them. I would want to be able to come home again.
Yeah, but I want to see my kids and my grandkids. And
but you have kids and grandkids. There are a lot of people who are not that tied to Earth. Maybe they don't have much or any family. Mm. They don't have the deep connections to society that some of us have. And maybe they just want to be famous. They want to be the next Neil Armstrong. They want their names to be in the history books so that they're willing to go and take the risk of going on a one-way journey with their fingers crossed that maybe by the time they get there, or maybe after they've lived there for 20, 30, 40 years, we will have developed the technology to bring them back home.
Let's, when we take calls next hour, let's see if anybody would take that one-way trip.
I think if they are willing to, they also have to understand that the risk isn't just that it's a one-way trip. The risk is that it might be a suicide mission.
That's right.
Because at the moment, we can't keep them alive on the surface of Mars. We don't have the food. We don't have the water. We don't have the ability to manufacture the food, despite what Matt Damon was able to do in The Martian, which was a movie. We don't have the ability to grow potatoes or anything else on Mars right now.
Can we even create a habitat like he was living in?
At the moment, no. There are a lot of people working on developing habitats that might work. But this, we talked earlier about ultraviolet light getting to the surface of Mars. That ultraviolet light makes the surface of Mars an incredibly dangerous place for living beings like ourselves. X-rays get to the surface of Mars. The amount of radiation that penetrates to the surface of Mars means that at the moment, we would die fairly quickly from radiation poisoning on the surface of Mars. So we need to invent habitats that can protect us from that radiation, and we haven't successfully done that yet.
Well, with David Weintraub, his latest book is called Life on Mars. David, you wrote a book called Religions and Extraterrestrial Life. How will we deal with it? Let's talk a little bit about that, too. What are your thoughts on ET life?
I think the bottom line is we have no idea what is or isn't out there. All the ingredients for life as we know it, water, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, magnesium, all the building blocks of life exist pretty much everywhere in the universe. The same stuff exists on any other planet in the universe as exists on the Earth. So life could come into existence somewhere else, but we don't have any answers. One of the things that got me interested in the question and in writing that book was that over the last 20 years, astronomers have become very good at discovering planets around other stars, what we call exoplanets. And we now know of thousands of these planets around other stars. The next step for astronomers, now that we've found these planets, is to study the light coming from those planets. And if you imagine for a moment that you could take a telescope from the other side of the Milky Way galaxy, you live on a planet 100,000 light years from the Earth, and if you could discover that the Sun has a planet, the Earth, orbiting it, and you could use your telescope to study the light from the Earth, you would know that life exists on the Earth, because you would see in the Earth's atmosphere the signatures of oxygen and ozone and methane, and all of those things come from biology. So you would not have to journey across the galaxy. You would have to not have to get into a spaceship and travel to the Earth. You could simply use your telescope and look across hundreds of thousands of light years and be absolutely certain that life exists on the Earth. So having discovered these other planets, the next step for astronomers is to do exactly that, to train our telescopes on those exoplanets, study the light from those exoplanets, and see if any of them show signs of biology. What we are doing right now is we are changing the question, is there life in the universe, from one of pure speculation into a scientific question, which in the next century, we might actually answer. That's incredibly.
How far, David, could you be out with a telescope, a huge one, to see the city lights, let's say, from New York off of planet Earth?
That's a great question. I don't have an answer to that question. I think you could see the lights from the Earth, the unnatural lights from the Earth, with a telescope, probably anywhere in the Milky Way galaxy, but quite honestly, I'm just guessing at that. You would know that the side of the Earth that faces away from the Sun, the nighttime side of the Earth, should be dark.
Mm-hmm.
The only light emitted from that side of the Earth should be heat that the atmosphere and the rocks have absorbed from the Sun and then are radiating back into space, infrared light. And you would see from the Earth a tremendous amount of visible light that could not be the result of the natural heat from the Earth. And I think you'd be able to detect that from fairly great distances, almost certainly from anywhere in the Milky Way galaxy, with the current large telescopes that we own.
Well, then you'd have to conclude that there's some artificial light on that planet there, that third planet from the Sun, and somebody built it.
Indeed, you would almost certainly draw that conclusion.
That's exciting. And maybe one day we'll find that on other planets here. That could be
something. I think in the lifetimes of your children and grandchildren, astronomers will have studied the light from hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions of other planets around other stars. And if from all those other planets, we don't see signs of light that is unnatural, we don't see signs of gases in the atmosphere that could only come from biology, then we will draw the conclusion that our galaxy is a fairly lonely place, at least for intelligent life. But we also may discover on one or more than one of those other planets some of these signatures that tell us life is out there. Again, we have no idea right now, but we are on the cusp of making the measurements that will give us some of these answers.
We've had a lot of guests on the program, David, over the years who, of course, believe that life here has been seeded by extraterrestrial life, that they visited us. Regardless of where people stand on that, I think to think that this universe is not teeming with some kind of intelligent life is a mistake. There's probably billions of planets that support intelligent life out there.
There are certainly billions of planets that could support intelligent life. As a scientist, I take the approach of knowing that we don't know the answer. that, yes, almost certainly there are plenty of places where if you took life as we know it and put it there, it could survive. But at the moment, we simply don't have any evidence one way or the other that it's out there. But certainly there are plenty of places where it could exist. And if life naturally develops simply when you have the right environment, when you have liquid water, when you have a heat source, when you have the right chemical components, then life is probably abundant in the universe.
Of course, and with the Frank Drake equation, where, you know, he theorizes that the probability of life out there is astronomical, I think it's there. I think it's there.
And I look forward to learning whether you're right or not.
Yeah.
And I can't challenge you and say you're wrong because I simply have no idea. But I agree with you completely that the potential for life is huge beyond the Earth.
And now getting back to your thoughts about religions and extraterrestrial life, if we definitively find out we're being visited or that there is life out there like us, how do religions handle it, David?
That was the question that motivated me. And I was actually surprised to discover that most established religions would have no problem with the discovery of extraterrestrial life. I thought it would be a bigger bother.
I think they expect it.
Some religions.
Don't you? I think they expect it.
Some do. We have, especially among more conservative, more orthodox strains of Christianity, there has always been a view that life on Earth is extremely special, that humanity is the focus of God's attention, and we are created by God, and God would not have created other beings elsewhere because that would distract God from being focused on us. Now, that is not the view of all Christians, but it is a traditional view within Christianity that Christianity, mainstream Christianity, has wrestled with for a long time. But within most other religions, there is either a belief in extraterrestrial life within, you know, Buddhism, within Hinduism, Mormonism, Islam, all believe that there must be extraterrestrial life. Judaism takes no position on it, although voices within Judaism would say if God wants to create extraterrestrial life, God can certainly do it. There's nothing against extraterrestrial life within Judaism. There's just nothing one way or the other that says we know anything about it. But within other religious strains, there are clearly ideas that say, yes, life is out there. We know it. And of course, scientifically, we don't know it. But in the sacred writings of a number of different religions, there seems to be a strong belief that life is abundant in the universe.
David, in your career, what's the one thing that has just excited you, baffled you more than anything? Is there one thing?
Well, I think the biggest discovery in my career is one I had nothing to do with, but is a brand new one. That's the discovery of gravitational waves. Gravitational wave astronomy is like opening a brand new window on the universe. It's not light. It proves more than anything else that Einstein
was right
about how the universe works.
You know, if he were around with computers today, God knows what he'd be able to do.
I wouldn't even want to guess. He was certainly a smart dude, way smarter than me or most all of us. And he had ideas a century ago that we're just now testing. And the existence of gravitational waves is one of them, and it's a phenomenal new discovery.
I was watching a commercial a couple days ago, and there was a math professor writing his equations down on a 50-foot chalkboard, and he had these numbers and calculations all over the place, and then he turned, and the cleaning guy was cleaning the other side of the chalkboard.
Yeah, that could be frustrating, wouldn't it?
It's got to be.
The chalkboard's not the right place. But, of course, if you were a little bit younger, the younger generation, as he's writing on the chalkboard, he would have taken his smartphone and taken pictures of the chalkboard as he's going.
That's right.
And then he wouldn't have the problem.
He'd have his backup, to be sure. We're going to take a break, David, and come back with phone calls with you in a moment. David Weintraub with us. The incredible book he's written called Life on Mars. If you're into reading books about space and astronomy, this is one of them. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take your calls. And I would like you to answer the question when you call, would you take that one-way trip to Mars?